From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Tatiana Voroshko, senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. Our topic on this edition of the program, Moscow's ongoing attempts to undermine Western democracies. Our guest, Alina Polyakova, the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a distinguished think tank here in Washington. Alina writes extensively on Russian political warfare, Ukraine, and transatlantic relations. Her most recent report is entitled The Future of Political Warfare, Russia, the West, and the Coming Age of Global Digital Competition. In the paper, Alina argues that the Kremlin's political warfare against democratic countries has evolved from overt to covert influence activities. She says that while Russia has pioneered the toolkit of asymmetric measures, including cyber attacks and disinformation campaigns, these tools are so-called yesterday's game. Alina says the technological advances in artificial intelligence, automation, and machine learning, combined with the growing availability of big data, has set the stage for an era of sophisticated, inexpensive, and highly effective political warfare. For example, Alina argues it will be difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish between real and falsified audio, video, or online personalities. Moreover, she asserts the next Russian attack against the United States could be massive in scope and debilitating in its effects. It could make social media bots and trolls look benign by comparison. We'll talk with Alina Polyakova about these specific threats from the Kremlin and what Western democracies and individuals can and must do to deter such political warfare, as well as how to punish Moscow for its attempts to undermine democracy and the rule of law around the world. And Alina Polyakova joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Alina, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
And I'm also delighted to welcome back my colleague from the Ukrainian service, Tatiana Voroshko.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Alina, very briefly, before we get into your report, I would like to get your reaction to the move by the United States to order 60 Russian diplomats that it accuses of being spies to leave the country within a week. And this was in response to the nerve agent attack on a former Russian double agent and his daughter in Salisbury, Britain, on March 4th. What's your take about that response?
Well, it's a significant move. It's significant because for the United States, this represents the largest diplomatic expulsion in U.S.-Russian history. The closest that we've come was in 1986 when the Reagan administration expelled 55 then Soviet diplomats from the United States. It's significant also for an important second reason, that it was very closely coordinated with our European allies, NATO allies, and now more than 20 countries have moved to expel more than 100 Russian diplomats. And this was a huge and important sign of transatlantic solidarity and coordinated and coherent Western response to Russian aggression against our Western allies, particularly in this case, the United Kingdom.
So it's significant, but to what extent is it really sufficient, given that this is really a terrorist attack on UK soil?
Well, it's certainly not sufficient. It is important as a show of transatlantic unity and coordination. I think it sends a very clear message to the Kremlin that the United States stands close with its allies and supports critical allies like the UK against Russian aggression, Russian attacks on their soil. But it's also a baby step. I mean, clearly to deter Russia, this was much more of a symbolic move, and we need to do much, much more.
Like what?
So, for example, we could get on the offensive when it comes to exposing corrupt Russian officials' dirty money. Russian elite use Western institutions to hide money they steal from the Russian people. They use Western banks. They buy up real estate, driving up prices in London, New York. There's a lot more that we in the West, the Western intelligence agencies, can do to expose this dirty money and go after it. This would really hurt the Kremlin elite without affecting the Russian people.
Let's get to your report, Alina. Now, you do argue that the future of political warfare is in the cyber domain. Talk about the threat that you see it.
Well, we have all been obsessed and consumed by Russian trolls, Russian bots, and their ability or attempts to influence our national discourse or even to try to sway people's votes during the elections. But frankly, the more we find out about what the Russians did, primarily from the special counsel indictments, is that it was relatively unsophisticated. They could have done a lot more. And a lot of the issues we have in the United States and the Western European countries in terms of our polarization, divisions, these are things that we have because we're democratic societies and this is normal. What the Russians were able to do is find these wedge issues and amplify and magnify them. But this is just the beginning of political warfare, in my view, because these tools will develop as machine learning gets more sophisticated, as artificial intelligence becomes more sophisticated. And also, I think what's particularly scary to me and deeply concerning is there's a recent New York Times article that detailed the Department of Homeland Security and FBI assessment that there was Russian-linked malware identified in the critical infrastructure systems of the United States. And these are basically cyber bombs that the Russians have planted on our electrical grids, water, nuclear energy sources, that they could detonate any time, literally at any time. It's unclear why they haven't done so. Maybe this would be too much of an escalation. They're afraid of the potential consequences of retaliation that would be much more than expelling Russian diplomats from the United States and elsewhere. But clearly, they have burrowed in our systems, they've infiltrated our systems, and this has gone far beyond the social media space, and it presents a real and present threat.
Let me turn to my colleague, Tatiana, for a question.
Yeah, I would like to talk about cyber bombs a little bit in more detail later on, but about the trolls. So all those methods which Russia used in the United States have been battle-tested in Ukraine and before that on Russian population. So Russia seems to have the full information control within the country. At the same time, we see the situation. We had this horrible fire in shopping mall in Kiryev Kemerovo in Siberia, where we know that at least 64 people died, most of them children, in horrendous circumstances, just burned life. And at the same time, we see this information control and a complete PR disaster. On Facebook, in some of the media, there are a lot of witnesses or people who lost their children. They speak very openly, and there's a lot of outrage brewing in Russia.
That's right. This tragedy in this shopping mall in this small Russian town, one, it's absolutely detrimental. Two, what you're pointing out, I think, exposes what Russia really is. And by that, I mean, in the West, the reporting on Russia makes Putin out to be this puppet master, that the Kremlin, with Putin at the top, has complete control of the Russian population. In fact, Putin is even playing this complicated geopolitical chess game with the United States, with Europe, with Ukraine, and that he is some sort of mastermind. But what we're seeing in this very clear example, when you have a tragedy on Russian soil, is that, in fact, it exposes the inefficiencies and inability of the Russian government to secure and ensure the safety of their own people. And the Russian people, they are not shy when it comes to their own populations suffering or dying. I mean, one reason why Putin was so concerned with the war in Ukraine, which you mentioned, is that if Russians saw young Russian soldiers coming back in body bags, this is going to have huge, profound consequences for the regime. And what we're seeing now is that even within Russia itself, the local authorities failed, the police failed, any sort of potential emergency checks like fire alarms weren't pulled. Why did this happen? It's a completely preventable tragedy, it seems. Not this many people had to die, and maybe not anybody really had to die if the system actually worked, if the local authorities did their job, but they don't.
And it's not just tragedy itself, but what followed after that. All those statements by Tuleyev, who is the governor of the region, or by some of the Putin who just came in, he did not meet the people who lost their children. The statements like one of the people's deputies saying that she's sorry for Putin because she has to go through it. So even the aftermath was horrendous.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think Putin has created this image of himself as this, you know, alpha male who's kind of above politics. The Russian elections just happened on March 18th. And the way Putin behaved in those elections was as someone who doesn't want to get his hands dirty in actually going and speaking to the Russian people. I mean, on the ground in non-manicured, non-set-up kind of environments that you have with a television stage, for example. And he shows up as an attempt for a PR, I think, a shot of him saving children and being emotional and empathetic to these Russians in Kemerovo. And what happens is the opposite of that. And it shows, again, the extent to which Putin is so far removed from the reality of what is actually happening in Russia.
And we know that he's vulnerable because only a vulnerable despot like him would resort to tactics that we're talking about, this disinformation campaigns, trying to create chaos in Western democracies. And also with respect to that horrible tragedy, the fire and the deaths, he was blaming the United States for expelling diplomats, trying to change the subject. Again, blaming, how could you do that on a day after a terrible tragedy? Again, changing the subject and deflecting blame. Well, back to what you were talking about before, a Russian malware that could affect our critical infrastructure. I'm very concerned because we have midterm elections coming up. Talk about the real potential for this, Alina, Russian malware shutting off the power, perhaps sabotaging the energy grid, and particularly, what if there's perhaps a blackout on election day? I mean, this is very serious because the Kremlin has every reason to want to undermine our democracy and undermine our elections.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we have to ask the question of why did these cyber hackers plant this malware in our systems, and they did not detonate it. The way that Russian intelligence operations, Russian asymmetric measures work is just to show that they can. They don't necessarily need to impose this kind of pain because the retaliation would be great. Russia is a weak power. Economically, it's very vulnerable to significant Western sanctions. We're not at that significant level yet. They could really get hurt if Putin oversteps the red line. And that would be a red line, sort of a shutdown of an electrical grid across a U.S. state, for example, that's easily linked to the Russians. But they want to plant the clear understanding that they could do something. And in fact, when it comes to our elections, they wouldn't need to do a full electrical grid shutdown. Why bother? We also know that Russian-linked hackers have also infiltrated voter rolls, and they could delete a bunch of voter registration information at just a couple of localities. And what happens? Somebody goes to vote, their name's not on the list, they're turned away, they have to file a provisional ballot. But what happens if somebody files a provisional ballot? It gets sent in, and then the person who receives it in that locality double checks if this person actually lives where they live. And what did they use to double check? The voter registration rolls. If those voter registration rolls have been tampered with, don't exist, it basically disenfranchises people from being able to take part in the elections. And they would only have to do this in a few places to sow the kind of distrust and discontent around an election result.
We'll continue with that topic in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Alina Polyakova, the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Tatiana Voroshko. She's senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. And we're discussing Russia's use of the digital space to conduct political warfare and how to combat it. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Charlie Race from Lima, Peru. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Alina Polyakova. A follow-up with respect to our midterm elections and the extent to which the Russian government could try to upset them or create chaos. We know that at least our government has rhetorically said that they are determined to protect our electoral process. To what extent do you think we are prepared across the country to protect our electoral system?
Well, I think there's two issues here. One is the defense and the security of our voting machines. And then the other issue is this bigger disinformation issue. And they're somewhat separate. So when it comes to the security of the voting machines, it's quite complicated because some localities use voting machines that are almost 20 years old because many states switched to electronic voting after the 2000 presidential elections. And we know the reasons for that. And obviously, a software, think about it, that's almost 20 years old is, of course, incredibly vulnerable to a cyber attack. But again, there's no homogeneity in these kinds of machines across the country. So every district in every county potentially has something different. So that makes it more challenging for a potential cyber attack, but it also is potentially a huge vulnerability once they find a back-end way in. So in that sense, I think we're very vulnerable. Somebody actually wanted to mess with the election results, they could probably do that at the local level in many places. So I'm very concerned about election security. When it comes to disinformation, I think at this point, a lot of it has been exposed because of all the news coverage and all the heat that social media companies are now taking, Facebook, Twitter, to some extent Google, though they've gone off a bit easy in my view. They are now being called to Congress to testify. Their stock prices are dropping. And I think the American people are seeing this and they're growing pretty disenchanted. So that means it's going to be much more difficult for a Russian disinformation campaign to happen at the same level, to the same extent as we saw in 2016.
Yeah, Ukraine has been a victim of interference from Russia, both in cyber and in disinformation campaign, election campaign. In your article, you write that Ukraine is actually better equipped to deal with this threat than the United States. Can you elaborate on that?
Countries that have been on the front line of this, including Ukraine, first and foremost Ukraine, but also the Baltic states, have learned the patterns that the Russians use, the tools they have, and they've been under attack so much. If you look at Ukraine, the first known Russian attempt to sway the elections or to mess with the results was in 2004. And you know, we're in 2018 now. Technology wasn't what it is constantly. Ukrainians had multiple electrical grid shutdowns as well. Also, an attack that the Ukrainian authorities have attributed to the Russians. And this is kind of an ongoing constant barrage of attacks that we haven't experienced in the United States. The other thing that Ukrainians have and other frontline states have is, oddly enough, some leftovers from the Soviet days. So, for example, when Ukraine experienced a electrical grid shutdown in which the hackers were basically able to take over the system and control it, they ran to the Soviet-era manual switches and were able to use that to turn the electricity back on before this became a real national disaster. In the United States, one, we have a pretty disintegrated system when it comes to utilities and energy, not such a centralized system like you have in some of these post-Soviet countries. And on the other hand, they're much more electronic, they're digital, they're based on new technology, and we don't have those same tools, those old tools, to be able to respond as quickly as Ukrainians were.
Alina, you talk about the need for a deterrence strategy against this kind of political warfare by Moscow. What does an effective deterrence strategy look like, in your view, against this political warfare?
I think this is the key question that policymakers need to be struggling with if they're not. Clearly, we have not paid enough attention to our adversaries' willingness and capacity to use technology, specifically in the cyber domain, to undermine our societies. And I think the question that we've come to now, well, do we end up having a sort of cyber attack, tit for tat, pre quo quo with Russia, or maybe even China, if China wants to get into this game? I think a lot of these adversarial states to the United States, China, North Korea, Iran, have been watching what the Russians have been able to do and what they've been able to get away with. And unless there's a much stronger response, just because the Russians launched a disinformation campaign against us doesn't mean that we should do that to them. In fact, the U.S. government should not be putting out fake information, false information, nor should any of the Western media. That would be against our democratic principles. But there are other things we can do. We talked about sanctions a little bit. We are on a scale of 1 to 10 when it comes to the severity of sanctions against Russia, maybe at a 3 or a 4. That means there's a lot more we can do to ratchet up the sanctions regime, not just against Russian individuals that I mentioned before, but also against specific revenue areas for the Russian state, like energy. So sanctions are one tool. The other tool is, of course, using our intelligence and cyber capabilities, but this has to happen in the classified space. So we as the public will probably never see anything that's done there. But clearly, U.S. capabilities in the cyber domain are likely much better developed than Russia's. And there's a lot more damage that we can do in the same way that they have planted these cyber bombs that we were talking about early in our critical infrastructure, just to show us that they can. We can do the same thing to them just to show them that we can. Doesn't mean we have to. But I think what we're going to probably enter in the very near future is what we had in the 20th century with nuclear non-proliferation agreements. That completely transformed geopolitics, the nuclear age. And it is this new cyber age that is transforming geopolitics in the 21st century. And we're going to have to figure out the tools of how we keep a peace despite all of these new developments.
But it's possible that the United States already have planted cyber bombs in the Russian infrastructure. It's a pretty high probability, I think.
I don't know. I don't have access to intel, but potentially that is true.
And then we're talking about, again, disinformation campaign. Facebook is making a lot of statements. They're changing the rules. They're trying to do something to protect data of their customers. What do you think they should do, and do they do enough? So what do you think about Facebook policies?
The social media companies, I think, have acted in pretty appalling ways, frankly. They haven't come to the table voluntarily. They have started to do some things. You have to give them some credit. I do think some of the changes that Facebook is making will have some effect. But I think the reality is that their revenue models are already baked into their systems, and the revenue models are based on ad dollars. So if we go back and look at how the Russians carried out their disinformation campaign with very little money, they were using ready-made tools that these companies gave them and wanted them to use. They said, you know, you want to target 18 to 24-year-old white men in Michigan in purple districts? Here you go. A couple of dollars, you can do that. You have access to all this very, very fine data. So until they change how they're thinking about these customized sets of micro-targeting, that they're not allowing advertisers access to this, which is going to hurt their revenue significantly. And on Twitter, it's a slightly different problem, where Twitter has never come forward about how many automated accounts exist on their network. Why? But again, they make their money from advertising dollars. Who wants to advertise to a bunch of bots? No one. So if they actually shut down all the automated accounts in their network, that may potentially cause them to drop 30% or 20%, I don't know what it is, in users, which would make advertisers run in the other direction because they thought they were advertising to billions of people and then it turns out they weren't. So Twitter has not been very forthcoming on any of these issues, and they're seeing the consequences of that now. Facebook stock prices fell billions and billions, and I don't see this stopping anytime soon.
But of course, individuals who use these platforms have to take a certain amount of responsibility. You know, they're using them for free. But again, we see they're not for free because the prices are privacy in many ways, unless we're savvy enough to know how to limit what we share and know the difference between a false post and a real, authentic post.
Well, yeah, there's no such thing as a free lunch, right? Nothing is really free. But I'm glad you bring this up, Carol, because one argument that Facebook, Twitter, the social media companies use is they say, well, look, the burden should really be on the user. We as individuals, as consumers of information, need to get much more critical and skeptical about the news we consume. But as most of us who are active on social media probably know, you're constantly bombarded with so much that even asking a user, when you see something in your newsfeed, to click on that piece of content and to do some basic research. So there's some tricks you can do. It takes you maybe 2 or 3 minutes to look at, is there a contact person? Is there an address? Do they have a board of editors listed, for example? What kinds of stuff are they publishing? Look at some of the other stories. But the reality is that most people will not do this. In this information environment where we all have information ADD, we're all overwhelmed, putting the burden on the user is actually a cop-out, in my view, because it's not really solving the solution. It's just shifting the blame to the public, to the individuals, without taking responsibility.
Yeah, and I will also add that the trust to the mainstream media has been undermined, and more people believe in conspiracy theories. So sometimes maybe we don't even need Russian trolls. We have the people who spread those conspiracy theories, which in many, many occasions look just like they were built in St. Petersburg, but maybe they weren't.
We like to think that it's easy to tell the difference between a propaganda story or a misinformed story and something real. But actually, it's not so easy. The reason why RT, for example, Sputnik, these Russian propaganda, state-funded propaganda channels have been effective is because they report the truth some of the time, and then they mix in lies and false statements and things like that. And that's why it's so hard to tell the difference.
Maybe it's hard to tell the difference, but RT, Russia Today, is a propaganda organ, full stop.
Yes.
So anybody, you know, who's watching and says, oh, that looks partially interesting and partially true, should go back to the source. Like I said, when you're looking at Facebook or whatever social media, if it's not the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, or, you know, Washington Post or Los Angeles Times, again, I think that's our benchmark in many ways. So we do have to take some individual responsibility, but I agree with you.
But I'll tell you a funny anecdote that you might appreciate about RT specifically. A colleague of mine had jury duty, and they were waiting in the area to be selected and be asked. And he saw RT playing on the television in the waiting room. And he said, you know, I went up to the receptionist or the person there, and I asked, you know, why do you have this? And she said, well, you know, we used to have CNN, and some people complained because it was too biased. So then we put on Fox News, and other people complained. So we wanted something neutral.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I've heard this story in other contexts as well.
And this is somebody waiting for jury duty?
Correct.
Okay, this is outrageous. Very sad.
So
very disappointing.
A lot of people don't know. And because our media environment is so polarized now, right? You know, on Fox, you have one worldview. On CNN or MSNBC, you have a totally different worldview. It's like two alternative universes that these propaganda arms of the Kremlin have been able to plug into this opportunity, the gap in the middle, right? People are tired of partisan politics and partisan news.
As we close, Alina, one last question to you about what keeps you up at night with respect to political warfare by Russia, and if you had anything that you wanted to add about a big threat in terms of what Moscow could do. And also, as a corollary, you know, is it worrisome to you, or is there a problem in your view to see the president of the United States, who refrains from criticizing Vladimir Putin, even though our government has policies which are more aggressive in countering Russian propaganda and Russian nefarious activities. But some critics say if it doesn't really come from the top, it's not as effective as it could be.
So to take your last question first, we have seen this odd development of this disconnect between the president and the actual policy activities of his own administration, where the policy has become increasingly more hawkish, still not enough, as we were saying earlier, but definitely more hawkish. They've imposed new sanctions, the recent expulsions that we've been talking about. There's more sanctions to come, most likely. These are significant steps, and frankly, it's much more than what the Obama administration did at the end of Obama's term, when they knew a lot about the extent of and scope of Russian interference in the elections, and still had this very, very weak non-response, you could say. They didn't do very much. Yet, we now have this political climate where the shifts in the cabinet, we have the incoming new national security advisor, who's known to be a Russia hawk. We have Mike Pompeo, former director of the CIA, likely taking over the State Department, another known Russia hawk. So all the signs point in one direction, that the U.S. is going to have a much more hawkish policy towards Russia. But why is the president staying quiet? That's a good question. Maybe he's concerned about the potential legal repercussions of saying anything at all because of the ongoing investigation, but we'll see what happens. This may still change. I think what keeps me up at night, if you will, is actually more the future, because I don't see that we in the United States or our allies in Western Europe will continue to have that edge when it comes to innovation and tech. You know, countries like China, even more so than Russia, will pose increasingly much more of a threat. And we've relied on, you know, American individualism and entrepreneurship, Silicon Valley, to really be the driving force in global development of technology, and they have been. But is this model really sustainable? Are we going to lose an edge to authoritarian regimes that want to undermine the Western order and Western countries? And I think this is very, very close. This flip where the West will no longer be the driver of innovation is coming very, very soon, and that will have profound consequences for our security, our safety, and also the national security agenda of the United States and other allies.
Alina Polyakova is the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Alina, thank you for a terrific and informative conversation.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Tatiana.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Sidrak Franklin. And joining me on the program was Tatiana Voroshko, senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.